can train someone to do anything, but I can't train someone who's untrainable. That's core to entrepreneurship, how fast you can adopt a new skill, how you can accept it, and how you can work with other people using it.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. Is higher education broken? Maybe a four-year degree followed by graduate school and six figures of debt makes sense for some professions like doctors and lawyers. But what about for the rest of us? Frequent listeners may know that I spent a bit of my exile during the early months of the pandemic in Ohio, which made me really want to spotlight some of the state's interesting entrepreneurial stories. Enter Dwight Heckelman, who founded Columbus, Ohio-based GrooveU, which offers two-year diplomas in music industry entrepreneurship in focal areas like music business, live sound, interactive, and more. I had a chance to sit down with Dwight to talk about ways in which higher education must evolve, what programs should really be judged on, and the universal value of entrepreneurial skills. So let's jump right in. Dwight, welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing we'd like to start people off with, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
My official title is director / custodial technician at GrooveU, which is a two-year music industry entrepreneurship program in Columbus, Ohio. So my day-to-day operations are running that program, running that school, which I've been doing. We just entered our 10th year, and we're getting ready to start our 9th academic year. Our first classes were in 2012.
It's pretty impressive. You have an interesting story. I've read a little bit about how you got to this point and how you realized that this would be something that would be really interesting to pursue and create a whole entire avenue of education for a whole cohort of entrepreneurs within the music industry. Curious if you can tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. In the moment, it's a little bit timely. I started GrooveU about 4 months into the Great Recession. I was at Berklee College of Music and I was employed. And I think where a lot of people saw doom and gloom, I saw a market that was ripe for positive disruption. So for me, the journey follows, I guess my motivation for it is it's what I wish I'd had being in the music industry. I went to traditional college. It took me a while to find my path into that college, which was a music industry program. And then leaving there and feeling pretty underprepared for most of my career. I graduated college in 1997. And then 6 months later, we were meeting in the Renaissance Hotel in Nashville to talk about this thing called Napster. So for me, it was a whole, I was really prepared for an industry that didn't exist or wasn't going to exist in pretty short order. My journey led me through a lot of twists and turns, working for record labels and music publishers and recording studios and starting a program at a community college and then on to Berklee. And it took all that for me to realize that I think that the model that was being used wasn't really representative of the model that the music industry needed. I go back to my own sandbox right now. I'll start my own school. We'll see how that goes. And it's been really rewarding so far for us to try and be the voice of change in a market that's really primed for change.
I think that's one thing a lot of people are thinking about right now, particularly with higher ed. A lot of people are expecting it to be reshaped to some extent by the current pandemic. So just given that you follow this space so closely, what are your thoughts in terms of how it might be reshaped higher ed in general as a result of this moment we're living through?
I think we're at another moment where we're really ready for some disruption. We've been there for a while, but I think positive disruption is inevitable. I cannot see a world in which we go back to the way it was. I can't see a college making the case to a student to say, pay us $40,000 to sit on your parents' couch and watch the computer all day. And I know, frankly, I'm a little exhausted with the platitudes of colleges saying repeatedly, we hope you're doing well and we're all going through this together. And I've always viewed it the job of higher ed for us to figure it out, for us to take the lead and not you know, bemoan the fact that we can't seem to get it right. I think you're going to see a real fracturing of the instruction that is capable of being conducted remotely will really be pushed in that direction. And that's a lot of traditional education. And then I think you're going to see some segmentation into the careers that just don't allow for that because they require, I don't know how you train a surgeon remotely. I don't know how you train an audio engineer necessarily remotely, that they're going to have to be a lot smaller and focused and agile and accommodate students in smaller settings. I think the days of us thinking we'll go to school and sit in a classroom of 200 people and hear somebody lecture, those aren't coming back with any real success. That's something that can easily be conducted, you know, the way you and I are speaking today. It's going to be a lot different. And I think that's going to be really amazing and exciting.
I can't help but, you know, wonder why didn't there become a lot more democratization once we immediately, like we had these online tools for years now, we had a lot of ability for, let's say, Harvard to have 10x the number of students that they had. And for some reason, people were willing to still pay exorbitant fees in order to be in person. And I think that what you're saying is just that this pandemic has changed things because sitting on the computer, if it forces everybody to do that, regardless of what they paid in, it makes you rethink the quality of what you're getting. And also, just frankly, even the socialization aspect of it. I see all these virtual conferences, and there's a lot of really good content there, but you're not getting the kind of networking. And same thing with the academics. How do you network with fellow students remotely?
Yeah, and I think that's it's a piece that higher ed has largely ignored, is the idea of the importance of getting students interfaced with other people in their career, getting students to conferences, getting students to work with each other in ways outside the classroom that are along a career trajectory and not just fraternization, for lack of a better term. And like, that's not going to be able to be if this happens again. And I think we're all semi-cognizant of the fact that it's going to happen again in some way, shape, or form. That just can't happen in large settings. So it's the smaller institutions that will thrive by offering what they continue to offer, which is compact learning in a container that interfaces me with lots of people frequently versus a large campus where I'm one of 10,000, 15,000 nameless people moving between class sessions. So I think, yeah, you're right on the nose. Why did it take so long? Higher education is notoriously reactive, which is the whole reason that we started what we did, is we wanted to be proactive and not reactive to market trends, but predicting market trends and predictive and talking with people about what's coming.
One thing that makes me think about is we start to not just rethink the price point and what do we want in a school, but even the duration. And I know that your program is 2 years, and it almost makes me think, I honestly don't know off the top of my head, why is 4 years the default? Like, how did we decide that? And maybe that's not the right answer. Maybe it's 7 years, but maybe it's one as a default. And so,
well, I think what you're talking about, like what we learned or what I learned in the course of investigating opening this program the way that it did, was according to, you know, the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, and I'm going back, what was 10 years at this point, so I haven't refreshed this, but at the time when you looked at my field as the broader media arts, so Bureau of Labor Statistics doesn't do a great job of drilling down music industry. They lump us in with film and graphic design and the broader media arts field. Their surveys were showing that 60% of those in this field cited on-the-job training and a 2-year vocation award as their primary source of education and training. So the meaty part of the bell curve was 2 years of education and lots of apprenticeship. And yet, look for that program. Like, if that's what they say they needed and that's what they think was their primary source of training, then why do we even have master's programs for the music industry? Right? What is that really? Nobody's asking for it. People aren't entering the field with it and advancing. In my field in particular, it doesn't matter. I learned this as a 4-year graduate. It doesn't matter if I had 4 years, 6 year education, a doctorate, or took an online course for a year and a half, we all entered at the same level. There was no skipping the line. It didn't, nobody cared about your formal credentialing. So the education had to be something besides that formal credentialing if it was going to have value to you in your career.
Yeah, so that makes me really think about ultimately what do we want to get out of these programs. I think about some of the metrics that should be most important, and it sounds in-field job placement rate would be one that would be, you know, important to look at.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting it right on the head. That's a metric that isn't regularly tracked by a lot of institutions, by the vast majority. And I say that with full confidence because I was at those institutions and asked that question and was told, we don't track that information. Do the parents paying for this know you're not tracking that information? I think most students enter college with the idea that this is a pathway to a career. And if a college doesn't really have that outcome, they don't really care about how successful that outcome is, or maybe even more importantly, aren't regularly, religiously interfacing with those out in the field who are determining the needs of their field, then, you know, it is just for edification, right? There's not a lot of value to what you pay. If the value is in getting the job so you can pay back the loans and have meaningful employment, then that should be at the top of every forefront of every college admission discussion. Right before you come here, this is what you need to know about employment in this field, what it's like, how good we are at it, and how we make sure that 2 years from now you'll have a job. And it's just not a part of the broader college discussions.
I always go back to these U.S. News and World Report algorithms. And on one hand, somebody develops this algorithm for what everybody should judge programs off of. And the reality is then people try to gamify and they optimize for those particular things. And at the same time, you do need to have a few metrics, a few things that every program is trying to aim for. What do you aim for and what do you advocate that other higher ed institutions aim for that's going to help you create the higher ed model of tomorrow rather than of 20 years ago?
I think there's maybe two components to that. One of them is, of course, even if you read the U.S. News and the Billboard magazine, to split it into things specifically for the music industry and things specific to broader colleges, job placement is not a listed category for the most part, right? It's not, it is, or it's very lowly ranked. And I feel like, man, that really needs to flip. How are you getting employment? Not just employment, but employment in field. And how are you tracking it? That should be a very important metric. I also think that gaming the system, such as you said, it puts us all in the same bucket. And the simple fact of the matter is that I have to train a lot differently than a medical program has to train. We can't have the same standards. My industry is driven by different choices, by different soft skills, by different technical educational components that don't fit into a doctoral program box, nor does the English literature major and what they hope to attain match either of us. It's kind of smoke and mirrors at the end of the day. If I gamed the system to meet their metrics, I would be dramatically handicapping my students because we're not looking for the same things on the same level. If you start with the outcome is the job, and then that's 70, 80, 90% of what you're hoping to obtain, then everything else falls into place. How many teachers are credentialed and what are their credentials? That's a big part of what's happening, how many of the instructors there carry PhDs. It doesn't matter. Nobody in my field carries a PhD. So why do I need to have instructors who have PhDs? That doesn't make any sense for me. What's the percentage of debt the student typically has to attain, or what's the program cost relative to the average earnings in field? There's no problem, hypothetically, with doctors and attorneys spending six figures to gain employment, right? Because they take so much credentialing from states and things to get there, and we want that. But spending even half that amount for a field that doesn't ultimately peak for most of us at that same level of income, that should be a metric that should be evaluated. What do you spend to enter that job field? I think that's a really important one to look at as well. And I think it's ripe for someone to come in and figure out a new way. It's done based on the fact that education used to be a really extensive privilege that we afforded people. and we're not there anymore. Now we're starting to visualize it as it has to be more than a privilege and maybe a little less than an absolute, but somewhere between those two is where our education system needs to be.
Well, the other thing that's interesting to me is that when we're thinking about almost these black swan events, like having a major pandemic, it gets me thinking about how you frankly have situations where people thought manufacturing wasn't so important. Like, why would we need, you know, tests for things? And then you start to create a lot of people who are going to be really great at the jobs that you anticipate really having a lot of in the future. But the problem is none of those were manufacturing. And as a result, you didn't really, you leave perhaps an entire economy vulnerable. Now, I know it's not necessarily the same thing that when we're talking about like music industry entrepreneurs, it's not the same thing. But the fact of the matter is it does get to be a little bit too concerning if you don't create vibrant ecosystems to allow people to enter a number of different industries simultaneously.
And I think there is parallels even to my industry where right now the event industry is really suffering. No surprises there. We can't go see events. So there's all this very reactive shift to, we got to get the venues set up to do live streaming, where we have to talk about what drive-in concerts look like. And you're right. Like a year and a half from now, when maybe we're clear of all this, there's all this pent up demand for audio engineers who don't know how to run live sound anymore. They only know how to run live stream. It's not really the reality yet, but I think it's something we need to be very cognizant of, that you can't just say nobody's going to go see concerts. I think, although there's talk in the panic of the moment that people are like, nobody's going to see concerts anymore. It's changed everything. And I'm ready to go see a concert tomorrow still. And I think in a year, I'll be ready to go back and see a concert. I just understand the reality that I can't right now. And one of the questions we meet every month with our advisory boards in every specialization that we have, and we have a series of questions. And one of the really important questions that I really tend to key in on is we ask them, explain to me one thing from when we met last year that your workload has shifted. The percentage of time you spent doing something now that you weren't doing a year ago, or something new that's now occupying 15% of your time and you weren't even thinking about it a year ago. And we use that to drive the curriculum for the preceding year so that it tries to keep pace with the changes that happen inside of the industry. Because I can't just change everything, but if now a great example I always like to use is maybe about 7 years ago, we had our video panel and we were talking with them about the technologies and what they were doing. And one of them said, I'll tell you, my work's changed. Drone work. I'm doing like 20% more than I was last year. And we're like, oh, like in that silo of education, I might not see that. But by talking to the industry, we said, great. Okay. Next day we went out and bought a drone. Got someone licensed on it. And a week later, my students were learning how to fly drones. Now, that it was it 100% of the class? No. Was it even 20% of the class? No. But it started to occupy a space inside of the curriculum. It really does require that pulse on the industry without being ever panicked, but always trying to fold in the new tech skills and the new skills that are in demand.
How else do you think we've got to prepare the next generation of entrepreneurs to succeed in this kind of uncharted territory? Because I look at it and I say, it's difficult not knowing exactly what skills you are going to need. But given the fact that you are training entrepreneurs, and given the fact most of my background has really been in entrepreneurship, it's just, for me, like the ability to think quickly on your feet and to be a jack of all trades on some level. Those are some of the things that come to mind, but at least I'm not trying to, you know, educate people in the way that you are. So I don't envy the task. How do you think about preparing people for a very uncertain future?
I think about it the same way I thought about it before our current pandemic crisis. And that is that it really all revolves around your soft skills. And I'm not arrogant enough to think I can train someone to have the soft skills, but I am really confident in our capability to coach it. And to that end, we developed with employers a soft skill set that they told us they wanted every employee they ever hired to have. So we have an acronym for it. It's called HAPPY. It stands for humble, adaptable, present, persistent, and innovative. And so what happens with us is we're, as a part of curriculum, we're always looking for opportunities to highlight, this is the opportunity for you to demonstrate some humility. This is the opportunity for you to innovate. And we actually score our students on it every term. They score themselves, we score them, their advisors score them, faculty scores them, their peers assess them on it, and we show them term by term what type of progress they're making on each of these soft skills. The stick / carrot is, you can graduate our program and be a jerk. I can't stop you, but you get an endorsement from us on your diploma based on what your cumulative soft skills are. And we don't recommend anyone from jobs who doesn't meet that benchmark, who doesn't get that endorsement. So it has some real world consequences to the fact that if you don't accept the coaching. And what we've constantly heard is, I want to work with people I like, right? Whether I'm an entrepreneur or whether they're working for me or whatever the case might be. And I can train someone to do anything. All the technical stuff just falls aside. I can train someone to do anything, but I can't train someone who's untrainable. That's core to entrepreneurship, how fast you can adopt a new skill, how you can accept it, and how you can work with other people using it.
And I think that's probably a really nice way of thinking about entrepreneurship. I hadn't really ever thought about it like that. I'm just curious, when you think about the things that are specific to your program versus the things that are applicable to any entrepreneurship program outside of music, how much of an overlap is there?
I think there's a big one. I think that if we focus on the fact that being an entrepreneur is becoming more and more important because you either are one or you're working for one in my industry. It's the days of big record labels filled with floors of people where you're going to have a cubicle are gone. So I either have to be one or understand that I'm working for one, which means I need to think like one. I need to think about how I'm going to grow this person's business for them. And I think that as our collective societal structure gets less stratified at a lot of companies, that's a skill set that is transferable over and over again. Do I see an opportunity for your company to grow? Can I come in, even if it's not my job to grow it, and articulate it to you? Do I have an understanding of the resources it might take to pull that off? Yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap, whether it's working in the music industry, working in a graphic design firm, doing web design for somebody, like all those things. You have to have that understanding that I'm a boss, but really I'm not. I have thousands of bosses and they're called clients. Because they come to me and ask me to design their website for them doesn't mean I can't, as an entrepreneur, think about other ways to help them grow their business.
I think that's really well said. I think that this has been very helpful. I just want to ask you, I think wrapping things up, what do you think are the few things that people should be paying really close attention to if they're interested in following this entrepreneurship path in, you know, such an uncertain time? Whether or not they're pursuing higher ed and other types of programs right now or not, what are basically the ways that you think about the future and things that you would advise other people to be thinking about?
So I think everyone who's an entrepreneur needs to understand that you're in the business of relationships and the quality of those relationships. And that doesn't go away just because there's a crisis. So now you're thinking about how in this socially distanced environment that we're in, and in this environment where a lot of people are hunkering down, that's a great opportunity to start making relationships you weren't able to make before. I like to use the example of, we always bring in guest speakers and we always have lots of people. We have a weekly seminar session where we bring in experts to talk to our students. And when the pandemic hit and we all went remote, we made lots of reach outs to people to do it in this way that you and I are speaking today. And we got overwhelming response from people saying, yes, it would never have happened in a normal, can you Skype into my class type of session. Everybody was anxious to make another connection. And It was incredible. We were book solid with people talking to our students about experiences and music industry things over and over again for the last few weeks that we were remote. And I think that's a great opportunity for any entrepreneur now to reach out because people are hungry for a connection. So the relationship thing just doesn't go away. And, you know, what I always tell my students too, to the counterpart to that is for an entrepreneur now, when someone says, I'm really worried about, or this has got me really concerned, what they're telling you is they don't see a solution to a problem. And that's a huge opportunity for you, right? As an entrepreneur, when someone says, I would have, but this happened and now I can't, it becomes an opportunity as an entrepreneur to say, but what if we could? What would that look like? I know it doesn't look like what you visualize, but it doesn't mean that there isn't something there. There isn't a way for me to help you. There isn't a way. There still is a way for help you. There still is a way to do this. And you look to the live sound industry, or right now is a great example. Oh, we can't do live shows. And 60% of people are like, we're just closing down. And the remaining 40% were like, but what if we could do live shows? But if they don't look the way you think they're going to look, what if we could bring you to an outdoor field and set up a screen and they perform on stage, but you're in your car and we use an FM transmitter and you hear the concert while you sit in your, oh, we're still doing a live show. It's just not what I expected. I think where lots of people see threats, the entrepreneur will continue to look for opportunity. And as long as you always keep those opportunity glasses on, for lack of a better way to put it, you'll always seem to find it. But if you take the other approach, it's really easy to get discouraged.
I think it's a really good point. And frankly, that is the way I've always seen entrepreneurs, the ones who don't take a no for an answer all that quickly, or who try to, when it looks like there's not an easy way to get to the end of the maze, you get a little bit creative in finding a way to get there. But yeah, no, Dwight, thank you so much. I think that I'm going to get a lot of really interesting thoughts about how to succeed in the crazy, unexpected world known as the second half of 2020.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the back half of 2020. The first half has been the collective kick to the gut, and the second half is where we all get up and say, all right, now we got a solution to this.
It will not be second half, it will not be worse. That's a good way to think about things. Thanks again to Dwight Heckelman for making the time to join us. Really enjoyed that conversation and gave me a lot of food for thought. Hopefully it did for you guys as well. If you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and B. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.